Okay, I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting to order. It is March 19th, 2026 at 3:30 p.m. We do have Senator Vice Chair Bjorkman, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Tilton, myself, Chair Kawasaki. We do have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to thank the recorder, Carrie Tupou from Senate Records, and Chloe Miller, moderator with the Legislative Information Offices. Today we have four agenda items. We have a third hearing on Senate Bill 162, specie as legal tender by Senator Mike Kronk, a first hearing on Senate Bill 245, Arts and Culture Day by Senator Rob Yunt, and we have presentations by the court system that were left from the prior meeting on backlog and pretrial statuses, and then presentation from the Department of Corrections, the review of pretrial, probation, parole, institution, and recidivism. So first we'll take up Senate Bill 162, specie as legal tender. Senator Mike Kronk, if you'd like to join us at the front, and if you have any last comments you might like to make.
Thank you.
Third hearing on the bill.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Kawasaki. Senator Mike Kronk, District R. I really appreciate you guys' time, you know, looking at the bill and hearing it, and don't really want to spend a whole lot of time that can take away from other bills that are being heard today.
Okay. Well, when I guess what is the will of the committee? Senator Bjork, Senator Wilkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we move CS for Senate Bill 162 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Okay, hearing and seeing none, that is Senate Bill 162, work draft 34LS0873/N, is reported out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes. We will not take a pause. We'll roll right into the next bill, which is Senate Bill 245, Arts and Culture Day. Senator Rob Yunt is here, and his staff, Ryan McKee, are here to present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Senator Rob Yunt from Wasilla, North Lakes, and Meadow Lakes area. My chief of staff, Ryan McKee, will put himself on the record, and then he will proceed.
All right. Ryan McKee, staff to Senator Yunt. Senate Bill 245 would establish the 21st of June as Alaska Arts and Culture Day. Alaskans know how many amazing resources our state has to offer and that these resources make the state one of the greatest places to live. We regularly honor some of these resources with days such as the Alaska Wild Salmon, Alaska Mining, and Alaska Agricultural Days. Alaska's artistic and cultural resources should be no different, and they should be recognized and uplifted with similar regularity. Designating the 21st of June as Alaska Arts and Culture Day is a perfect way to highlight the creativity and dedication of Alaskans infused into their everyday lives. Alaska Arts and Culture Day will encourage the celebration of the many artistic and cultural treasures, tangible and intangible, that infuse Alaskans' lives with beauty, meaning, and shared experiences. These impart to the Alaskans' strength and resilience, economic prosperity and power, and serve as an inspiration for people all over the world to come and experience all this great and wonderful about Alaska. By placing Arts and Culture Day on the 21st of June, we help cultivate a unique cultural wealth that will continue to enrich our beautiful state for years to come. And then I would like to add that the House version actually came out with a CS, which would change the date to the first Friday of October. And so we'll look to the will of the committee, but we hope to get a committee substitute to mirror what they did in the House.
We know better than them, though. Let's see, are there any questions? I guess my question opening is just why the 21st? It's summer solstice. It's the longest day of the year in Alaska. Why that one was originally chosen?
I think we go to our invited testimony for that, for clarification.
Okay, I'll call testimony here in just a second. Okay. But why is the fourth Friday of October? Did you say fourth Friday?
First Friday.
First Friday.
And I believe that...
Senator Rob Yunt, for the record here, you know, honestly, we're not really sure. It's the committee substitute on the House side. I have no objection to it, but I would have to ask the maker of the amendment on the other side to know why they chose the first Friday in October. I'm fine with it either way.
Nobody's birthday?
Summer solstice seems a little more exciting to me. But.
All right. Well, we will. Are there any other questions for the sponsor of the bill? Hearing none, we're going to go ahead and open up public and invited testimony on Senate Bill 245. We have one person online to testify, Mr. Ben Brown, chair of the Alaska State Council on the Arts. Welcome to the committee, Ben, if you could state your name and your affiliation.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Benjamin Brown. I'm the chairman of the Alaska State Council on the Arts, and I want to thank the Senate State Affairs Committee for hearing this legislation today. I also want to thank Senator Yunt for introducing it and Mr. McKee and his staff for his work on the legislation. And, Mr. Chair, if I can go ahead and answer the two questions I heard posed. The first, I believe, was why the 21st of June? If that's correct, I'll go ahead and give the committee some information about that.
Yes, if you would.
Well, Midsummer's Day is a wonderful day in Alaska, and people are out celebrating and appreciating, you know, the vast, wonderful amount of sunshine and all the beauties of the Great Land. So that presented itself to us as a chance to also lift up arts and culture. But the chair of the House State Affairs Committee, Representative Bob Carrick, said, well, aren't we already pretty busy on the 21st of June? And I think she had a very good point. It is a very busy day, she was saying, in Fairbanks, but I think it's busy everywhere in Alaska on that day of the year. We had been thinking, and there was, you know, in Mr. McKee's testimony about this, for the bill, he mentioned how not only do we as Alaskans enjoy arts and culture, but it's one of the reasons that people are drawn from around the world to come to Alaska. So we thought that by doing it on the longest day of the year in the middle of June, in the middle of the summer in June, we would be celebrating alongside all those visitors from around the world. But I think the observation that it's already a pretty busy day and that it might not serve to lift up arts and culture, Alaskan arts and culture, as much as we would like, was well taken. And so once that suggestion was made, we thought about alternative dates. The sponsor of the legislation over on the House side, Representative Paul, and members of the House State Affairs Committee, and we've had some deliberations back and forth. And October has been designated by Congress as National Arts and Humanities Month for decades. And so that's a month during which state arts agencies around the country, like the Alaska State Council on the Arts, often have special programming, special activities to help their constituents and the respective states and jurisdictions appreciate arts and culture in their daily lives. So it made sense to be thinking about maybe sometime in October. But I also observed that October is a fairly busy month because we celebrate Elizabeth Gracevich Day, Indigenous Peoples Day / Columbus Day, and ASN, the annual Alaska Federation of Natives Convention, is in October, and then it ends with Halloween. So we thought if we're going to do it in October, earlier would probably be better than later. And First Friday is actually what we came to see it as actually being a natural fit. In many communities around the state, Mr. Chairman, obviously, First Friday is a time when local art agencies, local art galleries, and just individuals go out and celebrate art and have a good time kicking off that weekend. And so it seemed like that was a good fit. The other advantage to doing it in October and not doing it in the middle of the summer is school is in session. And arts and culture are integrally important to our educational system and all the things we do as we raise young Alaskans to appreciate what it means to be Alaskan and to incorporate arts and culture into their daily lives. So by doing it on a day of the week and not a numerically designated day, we will not have Arts and Culture Day fall at a weekend when kids aren't in school. And hopefully doing it on that first Friday of October will help people just, you know, kick off Arts and Humanities Month with a robust appreciation of Alaska arts and culture. So hopefully that answers questions one and two. I don't want to go on too long. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have, Mr. Chairman, or any members of your committee.
Thank you. Mr. Brown, are there questions? I don't see any questions. That was a good argument for the date, and First Fridays are very familiar with, I think, most people here. So thank you very much for the testimony. Is there anybody else who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 245? Do we have anybody in the room who wants to testify on 245? Any other members of the committee have questions for the sponsor of the legislation? Before we set the bill aside, do you have any other comments you'd like to make, Senator Yunt?
Yeah, for the record, Senator Yunt from Wasilla. I'm indifferent to June or October. I'm glad to hear that the amendment on the House side was to be the first Friday rather than a specific date every year that could possibly coincide with the wishes, you know, of certain things. But I'm glad it's the first Friday. It will make it easier for – we have a lot of amazing organizations statewide that the kids do participate in, and so I suppose October would be a lot better for that than June. Yeah, I appreciate everyone taking the time to hear this, and look forward to any ideas that y'all may have. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. If there's no other questions, we will go ahead and set Senate Bill 245 ahead for a future meeting. Thanks for being here today. We'll go ahead and take a brief pause so we can queue up the next speaker. I'll call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting back to order. We now have the Alaska Court System and our liaison, Nancy Mead, if you'd like to come forward. We don't have a presentation from you, but we did want to hear an update on sort of an update on on where the backlog is and how we're trying to meet the backlog. We appreciated having Justice Carney here a couple of weeks ago and sort of laying out some of the issues that are happening and some of the things that you're doing post-COVID. But we'd love to hear more, and that'll sort of put us in line talking about some of the things that are going on at Department of Corrections immediately after you.
Thank you. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel to the Alaska Court System. I had prepared a little bit about the pretrial population and how long cases are taking to resolve. Is that the sort of presentation you were looking for?
That would be very great.
Okay. Well, my understanding, of course, is there's some concern about basically why so many people are in the pretrial population at the Department of Corrections. So I'll try to hit that on the head. I'll next talk about the length of time it does take a criminal case to get to resolution, and then give a little bit of data about the backlog, which the good news is it's essentially cleared. We're back to where we were before COVID. But let me talk about the pretrial population first. Just in terms of vocabulary, the Department of Corrections calls the people that they have in custody the unsentenced population. It's colloquially pretrial. And I think the distinction is there is a time period for some defendants where they've had a trial or have pled guilty, but they have not yet been sentenced. The court system counts people and looks at people pre-trial, pre-disposition of their case, but after that, if they, for example, have a guilty verdict at the trial, there's about a four-month time period where those people still in custody have not yet been sentenced. And the reason for that is there's time for the parties to get their arguments together, their briefing together about what the sentence should be. And most importantly, the Department of Corrections has to prepare a pre-sentence report for the judge to use in many cases, not all cases, but in many. So that's just a small distinction, but it's 4 months about for most people after a verdict before they are literally sentenced. So in terms of whether we call them pretrial or unsentenced, I tend to say pretrial. So what creates the population? Well, obviously an arrest and a charge is what starts the whole ball rolling. It gets the person into the system. But upon arrest, the person is entitled to see a judicial officer within 24 hours. So at that juncture, the court has to set bail, has to make a bail decision. And they follow very closely, of course, your statutes on release before trial, mostly AS 1230-011. There are three choices, essentially, that a judge has for a pretrial person. First, they can release the person, what we call OR, release them on their own recognizance. They're just released back into the community. They have an order, basically, that says, you know, obey the laws, come back to court when you're told to, keep in touch with your attorney. Those people are OR. They are not in DOC's purview whatsoever. So there are people that happens to. The second is to set the condition that they will only be released with supervision by the Division of Department of Corrections, PED, the Pretrial Enforcement Division. This was added in SB 91. It became effective in 2018, a whole new group of people in DOC who supervises folks. And the idea was, look, you know, we're keeping too many people in jail because they might be dangerous, but we don't really want them out on their own recognizance because they might be dangerous. So this is a middle area where they're supervised by these officers. They might have an ankle monitor on them. They might need to go into an office periodically for drug or alcohol testing. The ankle monitor might keep them away from certain areas. So that's PED supervision. It's a tool that the court uses often. And so those people who are also pretrial are at least not in a hard bed at DOC. They are costing DOC some money to supervise, but they aren't the ones that are in custody that you hear about very often. So the only other option the court has is to set other bail conditions. And sometimes the defendant is able to meet those conditions and bails out, as you must know, and then they are out in the community. And sometimes they are not able to meet the conditions. These are the people who can't meet whatever the court said they had to do to get out, and they remain in a prison, in the jail, before the case is resolved. By the way, they get chances to come back and say to the judge or another judge, I want a review of my conditions. I can't meet those. If they're in custody for 48 hours, they're allowed to come back and ask for a bail review of another judge. That happens very, very, very often. And they can also get subsequent bail review hearings if they have any new information. And some new information can be, I can't afford the bail amount. So those happen. So later judges keep looking at these conditions that are set to make sure they're appropriate. So if somebody's still in jail pretrial, it's because a judge, or often multiple judges, have decided that the defendant is not a candidate for release. The statute says what a judge has to consider in deciding whether to keep them in. First of all, the only things the judge is really supposed to look at is whether that person is going to appear at their next hearing and what will reasonably protect the victim, other persons in the community. So those are the factors that the judge is considering. And the statute lists, well, how do you know if they're going to be a risk to the victim, others in the community? And the judge looks at your statute, and you look at the offense charged, how much evidence against them, what their record is, if they've failed to appear previously, the effect of the offense on the victim, any threats to the victim. So those are the things that the judge must look at. There's a list of about 12 of them. I gave a shorthand to decide whether the conditions should be diminished such that the person could make them. The statute also has a presumption that basically the conditions should be very difficult to meet for certain crimes, unclassified felonies, any class A, any sex felony, any DUI, any crime against a person if they've been convicted of another crime against a person in the last 5 years, any crime of DV if they've had a DV in the last 5 years. There's the legislature's clear intent that it should be quite difficult for those people to get out on bail. So that's the statutory framework. And when you see a lot of people in jail pretrial, mind that the statute is what's driving those decisions by a judge. And the only other options is to let them out with no supervision or to let them out with PED supervision. So that's who's in jail pretrial.
Can you stop right there to see if there's any questions? Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Thank you. How do you, if you know, how do the courts deal with those from maybe villages who are in urban areas and are on parole or probation? Maybe this is a question for corrections, but are there provisions in our laws to allow for check-ins via Zoom or via telephone so that the person doesn't have to, so that the person can go back to their village maybe or their rural community?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, I will mostly let DOC answer that question. I am aware that if people have conditions that require certain types of treatment, that certain types of treatment are available in the state only in certain areas, and that can be problematic. But in terms of pretrial, there is the ability to phone in for your checks. There are remote monitors, but now I'm stepping on the toes of DOC, so I'll let them handle that.
Thank you. Just on the question of the person from a remote area like Bethel, if they were to be arrested, they could be arraigned in Bethel and then not have to go to somewhere else, right?
To the chair, absolutely.
Not in Bethel, but in a remote, more remote place than Bethel. But could they be, do they have to go to Bethel to be arraigned or to the closest court?
To the chair, there are telephonic arraignments in some communities.
And when a person's arraigned there, is it the consideration often made that the person could be released if they're in a safe place and not like a murder charge or anything that's, if it's just something less than that, would they be generally released back into their own community then?
To the chair, the obvious answer, it depends on the circumstances of the case and how violent the crime charged is and what the weight of the evidence is, et cetera. But say it's an assault and the court can set other conditions such as a third-party custodian. So you might be able to be released with somebody who's willing to watch you 24/7 and report back to the court if there is any breach of any of the other bail conditions. So, yes, people can be released in their own communities.
And then for bail conditions, when there's a dollar amount, how many folks, if you've got an idea, that just can't pay the bail amount? There's just no way they could personally pay it.
To the chair, there are some like that. One thing to bear in mind when you hear people are held in jail just because they can't afford the bail to get out, one of the things that the judge looks at is the person's financial ability to make bail. For example, if somebody is of tremendous means and the judge feels that they are still a danger to be released, they might set a bail of $3 million thinking, it will not even be attainable for this person. And if a person appears not to have means and doesn't have employment, the judge takes that into account and sets $100. And that still might be too much for that person to meet. But in some ways, the judge bears – that's – that's a way to say, I don't want this person to be out into the community with that bail amount.
Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you very much, Chair Kawasaki. Ms. Mead, thank you for joining us today. My questions revolve around the times where people are released to a third-party custodian. There's been significant concern in my community that folks released to a third-party custodian somehow aren't meeting the terms of their release, and then sometimes they are granted credit for their time served with a third-party custodian as a way to shorten their prison sentence. Could you talk about kind of that interface between courts and corrections and how decisions get made by judges about whether or not to apply time spent on third-party release as a part of this person's sentence, and talk about how often and the frequency that someone who is under the custody of a third party winds up violating those conditions and they have to be remanded to corrections.
To the chair, to Senator Bjorkman, people do get, people who are in jail in a hard bed pretrial do, by statute, get credit for that time served. So if somebody spends a year and a half pretrial, 18 months, and then eventually, either with the guilty plea or a judge's sentence, is sentenced to 2 years, they get credit for that 18 months, so they only have 6 months left to serve. That's credit for time served. That statute, which I don't have in front of me, also allows credit for time in certain treatment. So if you have secure, I believe it is, residential treatment. Basically, that's very restrictive, and you spend 6 months there pre-trial, you can get credit against your time served. Credit against time served is not available for time that you spend out under the supervision of a third-party custodian. That is not considered equal enough to jail time to merit credit. Now, maybe in this, if you're thinking of certain circumstances, the person was also in some sort of restrictive treatment setting as well. A third-party custodian can be, you know, your mom or a friend, and they have the duty. They have to say in writing and orally that they know they have the duty to report the person if they do violate their bail conditions. For example, they might have a bail condition that says you may not go to an establishment that serves alcohol because maybe the offense had to do with drinking. And that third-party custodian is required to turn the person back in, as you're mentioning. If they don't, they can be charged with a crime. That crime is not often charged. I don't know if that means it doesn't often happen or it just isn't often charged. We don't see too many of those, but we do see some. And the person has to swear that they'll do it and that they say they understand their duty to do it. And I don't know if I've answered enough your questions about that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay.
Okay, so that's who's in pretrial. That's who you're concerned about is kept in jail pretrial. And yes, the fact that they get credit for time served is you know, I think, important to keep in mind. And even though I'm saying pretrial, and some on this committee know very well, but most cases, of course, don't end in a trial. This is just pre-resolution. And last year, for example, our felony trial rate was 2.5%. So only 2.5% of felony charges end in a trial. For misdemeanors, it's less than 1%. So how do they end? Well, last year's felonies, 62% were guilty pleas and 35% were dismissals. The vast majority of the dismissals are dismissals by the prosecution. So those happen short of a trial, and both of those, guilty pleas and dismissals, if they're by the prosecution, which is most of them, happen without the court's involvement. That is the prosecutor looking at his case file and trying to make a negotiation with the public defender or the defense attorney, or looking at the case file and realizing these witnesses are just not believable, or I can't prove this beyond a reasonable doubt, I need to dismiss it. So bear in mind when you're thinking of pretrial, it's predisposition. Most cases just don't go to trial. Okay. So
before you go on there, I actually missed a question that I was going to ask relating to when a person is released, if they violate a condition of their release. When is that figured out? And is that something that the court does, or is that something that the probation, pretrial probation parole does to enforce it?
To the chair. So if people are out on their own recognizance, it's different from if people are out under the supervision of the pretrial enforcement division. If you're out on your OR and you violate a condition, let's just use the same example, and you go into an establishment that serves alcohol and you weren't supposed to, you will be reported or charged with a VCOR, violating conditions of release, if some law enforcement officer stops you, maybe for another reason, maybe just knows you're out on bail and happens to notice this. Maybe you run a stop sign and they run your name and figure out you have bail conditions. But if you're out under the supervision of the pretrial enforcement division, you are much more closely monitored, of course. And we see a lot more VCOR charges for people now that we have the pretrial enforcement division. They're catching people doing what they weren't supposed to be doing, either going into a area they're not supposed to go, near the victim, might be a zone that they're restricted from, or into a store that they've had a theft charge at, or into, you know. So we see a lot of VCOR charges brought by the pretrial enforcement division.
Okay. Thank you. I think you can continue now.
Okay. And then in terms of decreasing that pretrial population, which everybody wants to do, of course, we could let more people out on their own recognizance or through PED. But one of the ways would be to move cases faster so that people aren't in there so long, of course. And that's something that nobody in the system thinks is satisfactory, how long cases take to get to resolution. Since I got this job with the court system in 2002, I've been on many, many, many committees designed to lower the time to disposition. It is a very difficult and systemic problem. It's improving somewhat, and I'll get to that in a minute. But what the court does is has a policy that if the attorneys are ready, we will have a judge in every courtroom. And that means that if judges are busy, we pull in retired judges to cover any trial if the parties are ready to go to trial. So for every Monday morning, in a month, they might schedule four trials to start at 8 a.m. Monday morning, and knowing that this deadline is going to cause three of them to enter a guilty plea or to get dismissed, or usually the guilty plea at that point. But what if two are going to go? Well, they need to call in a retired judge, and we do that. We always try to provide a judge if the parties are ready. So how do the cases take so long? It's mostly, almost exclusively, because one of the parties asks for a postponement because they're just not ready to go to trial. So you have a trial date for, March 28th, and on the week before, March 21st, there's the conference. Are we ready to go? And one of the parties says, "No, Your Honor, I can't go to trial in 1 week." And so they have to ask for a postponement, which is a continuance. They have to give good cause. But here are just a few of the reasons I'll skim through that people might need more time. One of the big reasons is attorney turnover. So during this whole pretrial period, it might be that the public defender retires or resigns or gets a better offer elsewhere. It might be that The public defender discovers a conflict of interest within their department and has to give the case over to a different attorney in OPA. It might be a defendant with a private attorney, has a dispute with that attorney, and needs to fire the attorney and get somebody else. This is not at all uncommon. You hear from the agencies about their level of turnover and how difficult retention is. So when the prosecutor or public defender cannot continue in the case, guess what? You get a new attorney. They need to start over. They have to pick up in the middle. They don't know where the negotiations are, what the evidence is, et cetera. You cannot, a judge is very hard pressed to say, go to trial anyway, if an attorney says, I'm not ready. Because then what happens is you've set up an appeal. You can appeal on the grounds that you did not have effective assistance of counsel. So even though it would be nice for the judge to be able to say, just go ahead anyway, I'm forcing you to trial, you knew about this date, it can backfire and result in years of appeals sometimes. So new attorney, quite common in a case. Another very common one is new discovery is released or uncovered. And discovery means that in our system, the defendants are not surprised by the facts. They are, the prosecutor discloses to the defense what the evidence is against them so that everything is fair. And lots of times that is delayed or discovered late. It might be because APD doesn't get their information to the prosecutor's office. The crime lab is backed up. An expert witness hasn't had time to create their report in the way that they want. But late discovery and provision of discovery is an ongoing issue, the subject of many hearings, pretrial in criminal cases. Discovery is getting much more complex. Somebody told me in one case there were 670,000 pages that were disclosed to the other side. Well, somebody has to be able to sit there. And when you're a public defender with 150 cases in your docket, it can be time-consuming to go through that sort of information to make sure you're giving your defendant an effective defense. Another reason there might be a motion filed to suppress evidence or to not allow an expert to testify or on something scientific or medical or something like that. Well, what if the party only looks closely at their case shortly before trial and realizes they have this great motion and they file it a month before trial, but, oh, we're going to need a hearing, we're going to need briefing, that's going to delay your trial. The new charge, the violation of condition of release that is filed in a case can sometimes delay the trial because that's, let's get the evidence about what happened there because we need to wrap it all up in one place. If the defendant has entered treatment but it's going to take 9 months instead of 6 months, the defense will ask for a delay because that's going to help the defendant at the end. The victim will often consent to that sort of a delay. Another problem is just plain scheduling. One of the 10 people required, you know, has a medical issue or whatnot, and it needs to be put off for some. So these are the reasons people come up with for delaying a trial. And again, the court could say, go ahead anyway, I'm in charge here. But that doesn't tend to get to justice, and it doesn't tend to speed cases along because the appeals then take another couple of years. So that's the struggle. We've been addressing this very well. I'll get into backlog, which I'd like to say is basically cleared. We have the number of pending cases now is fewer than it was in 2019. You're always going to have pending cases. There are 6,000 or 7,000 felonies filed in a year. So we've caught up with what COVID caused when we were getting many more filed than we were able to close. Another way we look at the backlog is our clearance rates, and that is the number of cases coming in and the number being closed. If it's exactly equal, that would be 100%. We want to close more than is are coming in. And in 2024, we had 126%. And since then, we've been above. So we've been basically chopping away at the backlog for the last 3 years in a very positive direction. And then I would just like to mention the actual time that cases take to get to disposition is the median time is actually not as bad as you might think if you just look at the media and look at the outliers. Okay, there are definitely outliers, and nobody is happy when a case takes 5, 6 years or anything like that. But But for misdemeanors, A, misdemeanors, the median time to disposition, that's what we say, time from opening to closing, is 4 months. That's not as bad as you might think it is. For C felonies, which is the hugest group, the largest number of felonies that we get, it's 5.2 months. For B felonies, it's 8.5 months. It does increase for the A's and unclassified. So your homicides are unclassified, and that's what you might read about mostly. That's 3.2 years. You can imagine, though, that the evidence in those cases is much more scientific and much more complex, and those are the reasons for that. I will wrap it up unless there are questions, because I know you have a lot of people after me.
Thank you. Just one question on the – so you've cleared all of those. Are the clearance rates still the same, roughly 62% plead guilty, 35% are dismissed by prosecution? Are those sort of the same stats that have happened over the last couple of years?
To the chair, those statistics about the method by which cases end have been fairly consistent over the years. They might go up by 2 or 3%. And that's the felony ones that I cited to you.
And so why do you think you guys are doing so well, I think, as far as catching up with the backlog that you had? Other departments are still blaming their backlogs or whatever we have on lack of people or lack of training or one thing or another.
To the chair, I am aware that both the Department of Law, the prosecutors, and the public defender have done very well in the last year or so with their hiring and retention. They are pretty much fully staffed or just have a 5% or 7% vacancy rate, whereas in the years prior, it was much higher. And this is obviously a systemic thing. And so we are very pleased to see them nearly fully staffed. And also the Supreme Court passed a few orders in the last year saying, you're really going to be asked for good cause. We're going to put strict limits on this. And everybody has cooperated very well because, again, no one likes all these delays to work to ensure that they're only asking for continuances when they absolutely need it. So it's been a group system-wide effort.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Mead? Okay. Thank you very much for presenting. We won't ask you a question about grand jury.
Thank you.
Instead, we will go ahead and take a brief at ease to set up for the next hearing. All right, we are back in order. Senate State Affairs now has a presentation on the Department of Corrections, just a discussion we should have about pretrial, probation, and parole, maybe on institutions, and maybe a little bit on recidivism. Generally, we want to welcome Zane Neiswanger, Director of Institutions, Department of Corrections, Dusty Dumont, Director of Pretrial, Probation, and Parole. There are also several folks who are either online or in the audience who can testify or for questions only. Kevin Worley, Director of Administrative Services, Dan Traxinger, Chief Classification Officer, Jesse Sloan, Research Analyst, Travis Welch, Director of Rehabilitative Services, and Jake Wyckoff, Deputy Commissioner. We also have the Commissioner here too. But they're for questions only. So you'd like to start.
Good afternoon. For the record, Zane Neiswanger, Director of Institutions for the Department of Corrections. I want to say thank you for the opportunity to be here today. And before I get into it, I'll just share. I actually started several years ago here in Juneau at Lemon Creek Correctional Center. I live in the Mat-Su Borough now. But I never could have imagined what this career would offer for someone like me. And I feel very, very privileged to talk about the Division of Institutions, which I have a great love and respect for, and our staff that represent our department so well. So The department's been asked to present a portion of the 2025 offender profile related to some of your questions, and I think we're going to start on page 6 here. There we go. Perfect.
Okay.
All right. So this slide represents a snapshot from July 1st of 2025. Unique offenders being supervised in some capacity by the Department of Corrections. And as you can see, the population's broken down into 5 categories of supervision. It's institutions, probation, parole, pretrial. And I just point out real quick, because I noticed with the court's presentation right before us, too, we all got different definitions of pretrial. And so when you're talking about Department of Corrections, pretrial is really pretrial supervision, which happens in the community, not pretrial offenders, which we call unsentenced in the facilities. And then we have the community residential centers. We call them CRCs or halfway houses, and sentenced electronic monitoring. We often refer to as sentenced EM. On this day and time, there were a total of 9,841 people in DOC custody, with the vast majority falling under institutions and probation and parole supervision. On page 7 is a graph that represents the offender population trends as they relate to changes in legislation from 2014 to 2025. You'll notice that separate data exists for each of the 5 types of supervision presented on the previous page, as legislation can impact each of these differently. I will just note that it's probably worth mentioning we can't necessarily declare good or bad outcomes based entirely on the passage of new legislation, as there may be other factors at play. Details for each of the types of supervision will be covered in the following slide, and a reference chart is available on the next page, providing a summary of each of the bills referenced on this page.
Can I ask a question about this slide? The after 2021, it looks like the number who are in pretrial, the total numbers are lower, a lot lower. Is there a reason for that?
For the record, this is Dusty Dumont. I think we can attribute a lot of the decline is COVID. And I will speak to that when I speak. But during COVID, the court used probation, pretrial services as a method to get people out of a hard bed. And as those cases have resolved, our numbers have lowered.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Page 8 is just the legislation that was referenced. On page 9, the Alaska Department of Corrections utilizes a program known as the Alaska Correctional Offender Management System. We call it ACOMS, to supervise and track all those who come under our care and custody. The data in this slideshow is pulled from that program. Though I won't read it, the State of Alaska Constitution, Article 1, Section 12, reflects a constitutional commitment to balancing rehabilitation with public safety and victim rights. The Department of Corrections directly reflects this commitment through our mission and vision statement. Page 10 is a map that demonstrates where each of our 13 adult correctional facilities are strategically placed across our vast state. And you'll notice in the upper right-hand corner is a breakdown of the Anchorage Mat-Su Borough facilities that are, as there's more of a concentration there that can be represented well on the larger map. Each of the facilities are unique and designed to meet different needs. They service varying custody levels of prisoners and address programmatic needs. And all but three, are booking facilities serving the communities where they are located, as well as other communities within their region. On page 11, this demonstrates the fluctuation of the prisoner population within institutions from 2014 to 2025. Included on this page is a breakdown of the population based on status of sentenced and unsentenced and federal hold, population numbers by race, and population by gender. Page 12 illustrates admission trends over time. These numbers are broken down by gender. Over the past 2 years, we have seen a decline in admissions, with 2025 reflecting the lowest admission count in the last 7 years. though bookings are down, and I'll just say admissions, bookings, we use those terms interchangeably, are down. Our population remains fairly stable. Right now we're at about 91% of our capacity. We have experienced a decline in intakes, but it's worth noting as well, we have experienced a more acute population coming through our doors, which will be touched on later by Director Travis Welch with HARS, Health and Rehabilitation Services.
I'm sorry, can you go back one slide under the prisons at a glance, and can you tell me on this unsentenced population, again, these could be people who are not, who are either awaiting trial and not able to be released, or people who chose not to be released, or people who are not sentenced but have been found guilty. Is that correct? And are there any others that could be?
Yeah, to the Chair Kawasaki, that is correct. That pretty accurately encompasses who would fall under that category.
Okay. And then I guess this is probably something to just take home. I'd like to see what the breakdown for the unsentenced that are in institutions are unable to be, either unable to be released, I'd like to know how many of them actually could fall under the to be released, but just have decided not to or have been pulled back. At some point.
To the Chair, understood. We'll do our best to provide that data.
Great. Thank you.
Did you finish that one?
So page 13 reflects the state of Alaska incarceration rate as compared to the national rate using a per 100,000 residents scale. Alaska generally trends with national incarceration rates. And there's a couple year lag on the federal level there, so the U.S. wide is a couple years behind on data. Page 14 represents the volume of prisoners at each facility and is mostly indicative of the size of the facility. You'll note the fun fact in the upper left corner that points out that our largest facility, which is Goose Creek Correctional Center, holds 25 times more offenders than our smallest facility, which is located in Ketchikan Correctional Center. Page 15 demonstrates legal status and length of stay using three different graphs. In the bottom left corner, you'll find a graph depicting the positive changes we've experienced by the Department of Law and the courts working to continue to clear the backlog post-COVID-19. On the upper right portion, there's a graph that illustrates non-criminal admissions over a 10-year period. And on the lower right, we have a graph that shows the length of incarceration with long-term, which is over 3 years, and short-term, which is 6 months or less, representing the majority of the prisoner population. Page 16 breaks down is a graph that breaks down the legal status on the previous page and presents the data by institution. And I will say that a pull of this data from yesterday shows that our current numbers are 43% of our population is unsentenced, 57% is sentenced. Page 17 breaks down our prisoner population by age with trends over time. We often refer to an aging population within our facilities, and I just feel like this graph does a really good job of demonstrating just that. You may notice that the groups, age groups under 40 are steadily declining, and then ages 40 to 49 and 59 and above are consistently growing.
It's the video game generation. Okay.
Page 18 demonstrates a breakdown of population by race over time. The two largest numbers represented here, white and Alaska Native populations, have generally trended relative to each other, but they did intersect in 2021 with the Alaska Native population replacing the white population as the most represented race in custody. Though we don't necessarily have any data to provide, we do believe this may be in part due to increased law enforcement presence in rural Alaska. And just a little plug here, just as a reminder, we are a downstream agency. We don't have a lot of control over who comes through our doors. The department partnered with the Alaska Federation of Natives to research the disproportionate incarceration of Alaska Natives, and Director Welch is planning to touch on this a little later in his presentation.
Great.
The other racial groups have remained fairly stable over time. Page 19 just illustrates the number of prisoners incarcerated broken down into the degree of crime that they are charged with or convicted of. Page 20 provides a breakdown of the prisoner population and their offenses. We often like to point out that crimes against a person and sex-related crimes are both crimes against a person, but because of reporting requirements, they are broken down separately. Considering this, crimes against a person makes up roughly 56% of the prisoner population. On page 21, this section covers community residential centers, which are, again, CRCs or halfway houses, and sentenced electronic monitoring, sentenced EM, which, again, it's different from pretrial electronic monitoring. The data presented on the next couple of pages represents these two programs, but also includes information about all of our offenders that are located in our four treatment centers outside of our seven contracted CRCs. The purpose of the CRCs is to increase the offender's opportunities for success by providing much greater flexibility to transition back into society. The primary focus is on providing needed programming and assistance to the offender in securing employment, housing, and counseling services. And our CRCs also focus heavily on promoting community service, work, and repayment of restitution. The sentenced electronic monitoring program is committed to promoting accountability, rehabilitation, and successful reentry while maintaining public safety. And this is accomplished by allowing eligible individuals to serve their sentences within the community under structured supervision and GPS monitoring. The program supports participants in maintaining lawful behavior while engaging in employment, treatment, and other constructive activities. Through active oversight by probation officers, our mission is to foster positive change, reduce recidivism, and help individuals successfully reintegrate into society. These are both tools that the department uses to assist in a softer transition from institutions to the community, hopefully ensuring a greater likelihood of successful reentry. I'll just note that individuals must meet certain criteria to be placed in either of these options, and also local ordinances can prohibit certain offenders from placement in certain options.
Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the explanation. Because we visited last time you all were here about capacity issues and budgetary issues, would you say that budget and capacity issues are kind of a force behind more people being on electronic monitoring and house arrests, and they get credit for time served when they're in that program?
Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, I would say that public safety and reentry are going to be the two major focuses of using those programs. That's my two cents on that matter. As far as, anytime we start, and not to be challenging at all, but anytime we start moving down the road of to save money and we start challenging what could be a bad public safety decision, or a good reentry effort, budget can't be the main driver of those programs for certain.
I agree. Follow up?
Yep, follow up.
So as we think about this house arrest electronic monitoring situation in which people are getting credit for time serving their sentence, how does that decision get made? What are kind of the rubrics used to make that decision, and who makes the decision?
Through the chair to Senator Bjorkman, I can answer some of that, but I would like to bring up my chief classification officer who oversees those two programs. I think he could speak to it very well.
Great.
Good afternoon. For the record, Dan Traxinger, Chief Classification Officer for the Alaska Department of Corrections. Through the Chair, Senior Senator Yorkman. The question is, how do folks get on Sentence DM? For individuals to be placed on Sentence DM, they have to qualify. They have to apply through a Sentence DM application process, which is reviewed and is either approved, denied, or we put extra conditions on an individual to meet prior to going out on Sentence DM. Each application is reviewed, and we make that decision balancing our need for rehabilitation and public safety.
Follow-up, Senator Bjorkman.
Very good. Would it surprise you to know that members of law enforcement and ADAs are concerned that this type of practice is overused?
Through the chair, I can't speak to folks, other organizations thinking that's being overused. What I can speak to is we have a Sentence DM program that utilizes technology with our GPS monitors. It's a 24-hour program monitoring individuals where they get day-for-day service for day-for-day for serving their sentence.
Understood. Thank you.
And I've been here for a long time, and I remember the chairman of the Corrections Budget Subcommittee from Fairbanks also, and his big push was to get people on EM. And so I know that we had probably 150 during that time. It looks like the numbers barely doubled, so it's not like a large number, but that was sort of a goal of the legislative branch 20 years ago or so, or 18 years ago. So I think it just kind of depends on what we're trying to do. But certainly, when you do put a person who's a sentenced person on EM, there are, like, they can't be a sex offender, I think, is one of them. They can't, there's like, there are some pretty strict conditions over who can actually apply to be on electronic monitoring, right?
To the chair, the biggest criteria that prevents someone from going on sentenced DM is a domestic violence conviction. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And to the chair, to Mr. Bjorkman's question, I think that there might be a little bit of confusion in the pre-sentence, people who are in pretrial services that are actually on house arrest pending before they go to jail. And I think that's the one that people are referring to maybe being overused. It's keeping them, it's extending their time of pre-sentence, and then once they're sentenced, maybe their time served. But there's rules around that too, around house arrest while you are on pretrial services.
Thank you.
There's a slide coming up next.
So page 22 uses, for the record, sorry, Zane Neishorn, Director of Institutions. Page 22 uses four data sets to illustrate the population housed at our community residential centers. In the upper left is the CRC population over the years. And then since 2019, the population numbers have been trending upwards with minor decreases in 2022 and 2025. And I will just point, these are numbers pulled from a moment in time on the first day of the fiscal year. So these, there may be a little flexibility in the numbers, but they're going to be very close. In the lower left, a graph that demonstrates the population broken down by age group with 30 to 39 accounting for 39% of the total CRC population. In the upper right, you'll see a breakdown of the population by male and female. And I think that it's just important to point out in the areas that we have CRCs, we have both male and females housed in those locations. In the lower right is a breakdown of the population by race, with Alaska Native and white together accounting for 85% of all placements.
On the CRC numbers, just the population looks like it's been down and flat since the COVID years and then may have ticked up after that. But why is that so dramatic over those 2013 to 2020?
to the chair, Kawasaki, you know, I should know the answer to that, and we even talked about it a little bit earlier, but I'm going to turn around to my chief classification officer again, if that's okay.
Sure.
All right. Thank you.
For the record, Dan Traxler, chief classification officer, the decline of CRC placements may be tied to SB 64, SB 91, specific SB 91 when PED was put into place. So instead of being referred to the halfway houses, they were put out on pretrial.
And so I'm on the budget subcommittee for corrections, and the CRC budget looks like it continues to grow. Is that, are they at a capacity, or is it, are they just cost more? I guess this is a budget question, but I don't know if you can answer it or if somebody can answer that. I'm just curious why the budget increases for CRCs has continued to gone up, to go up.
To the chair, I can speak to the capacity. So currently, as of today, we're at about 82% of our capacity at the halfway houses. But as for the budget, I would turn around.
Anybody?
Thank you.
Good Welcome. Afternoon. For the record, this is April Wilkerson, one of the deputy commissioners for the Department of Corrections. What we're seeing with the, to the chair, what we're seeing with the CRCs is the same thing that we're seeing with the prisons and the cost of doing business throughout the department. We're seeing an increase, whether it's the cost of food or services or even their staffing. And so as we are negotiating these contracts, we are seeing pretty substantial increases. Even on the healthcare side, when we renegotiated contracts coming out of COVID, some of those contracts doubled in some cases, and some of them even more than doubled. We did have a pretty flat line on a couple of the contracts that didn't allow a CPI increase over a few years. And then when they came to fruition and required us to renegotiate, we enter into contracts for every five-year period. And so as that fifth year was coming to an end and we entered into renegotiations, we saw some pretty substantial increases.
Okay. And just a one follow-up, Commissioner Wilkerson, is that the are the beds still paid for, completely paid for, so every bed we pay for whether there's a person there or not?
To the chair, we have one contract that is like that. We contract for 40 beds. We pay for 40 beds regardless of the number of individuals that are in those. The other contracts, we have one that is currently under negotiation that we only pay if the bed is filled, but that is going to a more modern type of pricing. So what they are doing now in five of the contracts is we have an administrative. So this is the cost administratively monthly to keep the lights on and a bed available to you. And then they go to a per diem type of pricing. So as we place individuals into those beds, then we have a fee associated with that bed that's filled.
Okay. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I don't see any other questions for you.
All right, and for the record, Zane Neiswanger, Director of Institutions. Page 23 is our electronic monitoring at a glance, and just for clarification again, the sentenced electronic monitoring program. Similar to the previous page, since 2019, these placements are trending upwards with minor decreases in 2022 and 2025, and we do intend to work to continue to grow these numbers in the next year. In the lower left, you'll see offenders broken down by age group with 40 to 49, accounting for 34% of all of our sentenced EM placements. And in the upper right is a breakdown of the population by male and female. In the lower right, a breakdown of the population by race, with Alaska Native and white together accounting for just over 81% of all sentenced DM placements. It's also worth pointing out that we have partnered with our partners in the community to expand sentenced DM using private contractors in areas where we are not currently providing these services. In fiscal year 2025, we processed 290 private EM applications, and in 2026, we've already processed 343. Wow. And if there are no questions for my block, I will turn it over to Director Dumont.
Good afternoon. My name is Dusty Dumont. I serve as the Director of the Division of Pretrial Probation and Parole, which we refer to as DP3. I only had a couple of slides, so I have just prepared some remarks, and if that's okay, I can share them, and then you can ask me questions at the end or interrupt me if that's what you want. And I feel like Ms. Mead spoke to half of my what I was going to say anyway. This first slide is our mission statement. It's a bit of a mouthful, but I will not read it to you, but at its core, it comes down to one word: balance. On one hand, our officers are responsible for public safety, holding individuals accountable to the conditions set by the court and the parole board. On the other hand, we are working to guide people towards change, connecting them to treatment, education, and community-based support. We don't just supervise behavior, we work to change it. Our footprint is statewide. We operate 17 offices across Alaska, from Utqiagvik all the way down to Ketchikan. Some are standalone pretrial offices, some are standalone probation and parole offices, and some of them are dual, housed under the same roof. Regardless of structure, the mission remains the same. The primary statutory duties of our probation officers and parole officers are public safety and rehabilitation. This is not one-size-fits-all supervision. It is tailored to risk and need. Our officers assess risk, identify individual needs, and develop case plans designed to support long-term successes, all within the conditions set by the court and the parole board. These conditions may include substance use treatment, mental health services, sex offender treatment, restitution, or compliance with community work services. Accountability and behavior change is a key component to public safety. Our officers reinforce positive behavior, but they also respond to violations. And when they do, the response is intended to be swift, certain, and proportional. On the pretrial services side, the role is a little bit different, but just as critical. We've heard a lot of the term about pretrial, and Director Neiswanger was really good about trying to differentiate the two. And then Ms. Mead was calling us PED, which when pretrial services was set up, it was its own division. And then there was an administration change, and then they were combined. And for the life of me, I cannot get rid of the acronym PED. So everybody says it. I don't think it's going away. But PED is pretrial services, is what we refer to it as. Our pretrial services officers conduct risk assessments on individuals who are in custody. We use a validated tool, the AK2SR, which measures two key factors: the likelihood of failure to appear and the likelihood of committing new criminal offenses. These assessments are completed while an individual is in custody awaiting arraignment and when requested by the court or requested by the court. Because we assess nearly everyone in custody, the number of assessments completed is significantly higher than the number of people who are released to pretrial services. We conducted over 17,000 assessments in 2025. Ultimately, the decision to release someone to pretrial services rests with the judge. Our officers may provide recommendations, but it is important to emphasize we do not set the rules. We enforce the rules that are set by the court. Individuals placed on pretrial services may also be ordered to electronic monitoring, which we've discussed as well. This is one of our most frequently used tools. At any given time, a significant number of individuals are assigned at least one form of electronic monitoring. and it's not uncommon for someone to be assigned multiple devices. Yesterday, we had a total of 1,096 individuals on electronic monitoring and over 1,200 pieces of electronic devices. Pre-trial services came into existence just before COVID, which kind of speaks to some of those numbers that we were talking about earlier. And I don't think we can definitively say how things move within our system, but we know that COVID definitely impacted. So we set up pre-trial services, and then we went into COVID, and we really haven't been able to really measure. I think we're starting to level out now, but we really can't use those predictors. Sorry,
Ms. Dumont, there's a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to ask you the same question I asked Ms. Mead, and I apologize, I had to step out for a minute. I don't know if you talked about it or not, but it's regarding those from outside of urban areas who are confined, who are on probation or parole. And I know oftentimes they have probation officers who will go to their houses and check on them, or they have to report to them. How do you deal with them if they want to go back to their villages or to their communities that don't have a probation or parole officers? Is there a way to deal with them?
There is, and through the chair. There is, and I think we are very good at dealing with people who are outside, especially with technology as it's coming about. What I will say is probation and parole officers don't have the authority to prohibit somebody to return to their community unless they have a condition ordered by the court that says that they have to reside where a probation or parole officer resides. I guess it would just be a probation officer. Parole board could issue that same condition as well. So they can return to their communities. There are times when they have to participate in treatment that will then, again, maybe displace them. But we have been really good about getting virtual sex offender treatment, virtual substance abuse treatment in most areas.
And, okay, just follow up. Do you know how many people are taking advantage of this? How many people have returned to their communities, their villages, but still use parole officers or probation officers in urban areas? Or maybe using technology to deal with their parole or probation officers?
Through the chair, are you asking me for a number that do that?
Yes.
I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I can certainly try to track down specific numbers. And just to be clear, you're looking for places like Fairbanks, Anchorage, that are supervising people that are outside of those areas?
Yes.
Okay.
My estimation and my guess is that there are probably not very many probation parole officers in little villages throughout Alaska. There are probably none. And so I'm curious how many people are returning back to their villages or rural areas where there is no probation parole officers but are still on probation and parole. And I guess that's question one. And number two is, are there statutes that we would need to look at that you would recommend we look at to make it so that more people can take advantage of that, more people can go back to their communities, their villages, where they have a support structure, where they've grown up, maybe they have friends, they have family, and would be more able to rehabilitate themselves?
Through the chair, I do, I will say that many people are supervised outside of a local hub. For example, all of the villages that surround Bethel, some of those people are supervised by officers out of Fairbanks. We have a certain number of officers that are assigned to the Bethel area. The part that gets complicated, it's a sensitive matter, but I want to be clear, is that when it comes to sexual offenders, it is hard to say, yes, you can return to a community where your victim resides, and we lack oversight. Our number one goal would be to protect our victims. And so those are things that we want to work with people on, establishing a care group, a support network around them, so that there's some accountability there. Sexual offending is a complicated thing, and I think most people don't know the ins and outs of that. And I'm grateful that people don't, because I think sometimes it's very destructive to our minds to think about that. But I think that we are handling those cases well, and in the cases where people aren't willing to comply with treatment and following through, then our only action is to hold them accountable with sanctions and discipline and maybe even jail. So, but I think the sex offender population is the one that you are mostly referring to that becomes more problematic. But I will get you numbers.
I'm not referring just to sex offenders. I'm referring to people, I mean, lock them up for a lot, you know. But I'm more interested in the individual who is out on parole or probation. Sex offenders, if they need to be in confined or, you know, whatever you need to do to keep the public safe, absolutely do it. But if there are others with in probation or parole that can we can figure out a way to get them back to their community so they can rehab, that's what I'd be interested in trying to figure out.
Great. I will get you some answers for that.
Thank you.
I like to call our officers change agents. Their role is to encourage officers to make a difference, to make different choices. Now the reality is not everyone is ready to change. Our communities have some unhealthy and addictive individuals. I have always said that if love could cure addiction and brokenness, that we wouldn't have any of it. We have enough love in our world to cure all of that. But the problem is that we need people to want to change, and sometimes people just are not ready. So we stay engaged, and then when we are ready, when they are ready, we are there. Because while accountability matters, long-term public safety comes from changed behavior. The right responses, the right time, for the right person, that's how change happens. Simply put, we reward what works and we interrupt what doesn't. The commissioner has been clear about her three guiding principles, and DP3 has aligned with that vision. At our core, we are focused on leaving people better than when they came and finding smarter and more efficient ways to do our work. One of the biggest shifts we are driving right now is bringing DP3 fully into a digital age. We are actively working to implement electronic check-ins through a mobile app, moving us away from paper apps and manual processes. Quite simply, less paper and more purpose. We are piloting this new supervision platform built around the idea smarter supervision, less busy work, and better outcomes. This system is designed specifically for community supervision and gives our officers tools that match the reality of their work. It includes mobile supervision, automated reminders for appointments and court dates, video check-ins, and AI-powered documentation support. The goal is simple: give our officers time back to focus on what matters most, people. Early estimates suggest we could return more than 8 hours per week to each officer. It also uses data to identify risk earlier, before it becomes a crisis, and support better decisions making to reduce recidivism. Because at the end of the day, better tools lead to better outcomes. In addition, we are working to stand up a pretrial step-down program. This will allow individuals who are doing well and staying compliant to move more efficiently through our system. This creates capacity where it's needed most, allowing the courts, which we heard today, allowing the courts to get unbogged, our officers to focus their time and their energy on higher cases, on higher risk cases. We're also working with other agency partners, exploring diversion opportunities this year, looking for ways to intervene earlier, reduce system burden, and connect individuals to the resources for long-term success. I've had the privilege of serving as a DP3 officer for over 23 years for the state of Alaska. In that time, I've seen our role as an officer evolve significantly. Our officers are managing more complex cases, more mental health challenges, higher risk individuals, and increase in demands on their time and their judgment. But I've also seen successes, real success. Sometimes short-term, sometimes long-term, nonetheless, both meaningful. So at the end of the day, our mission is straightforward: to make Alaska safer while never losing sight of the fact that individuals we supervise are still people in our care.
Question from Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Dumont, thank you for your presentation. I appreciate that you recognize that there may be a sentiment surrounding the use of pretrial house arrest and electronic monitoring and folks getting credit for that time. Does your department and do your folks have the ability to provide feedback to the courts about the use of that type of situation pretrial and its effectiveness? Do you have a feedback loop back to judges when they make those types of decisions that educates them on what happens after they choose that route?
Through the chair, we do. We try to have a slot to present to the judges every year. And, of course, it's not every judge all the time. But we do try to educate on what we see, the violations that we see, the trends that we're seeing. Judges do what judges do. And we can make some informed suggestions, but ultimately the decisions are theirs to make.
Understood. I think many people would be interested in providing some additional guidelines and feedback that would guide some of those choices. I know I've heard that in my community multiple times. Are there a different question, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead.
Are there private organizations that provide a similar parallel service to yours? Are there private companies who also provide the same service? And could you please opine on the similarities or differences between the two services that you all offer?
Through the chair, there are many different individual companies, independent companies that provide services. Each of them probably have very different elements that they provide. I think the difference would be that we are working for the state. We're not working for ourselves. Like, we're not a private company. We're not making money. That isn't our business. We're in the business of people and helping people, but the money factor is not there. We, as pretrial services, we have only worked closely with one company, but there are, like, it just in Anchorage alone, there's three that are independent. And I would say that we do offer different tools and we do offer different services, but I wouldn't be in a position to probably compare.
Senator Bjorkman.
In your experience, have you seen or noticed any difference in outcomes from one service to another?
Through the chair, I don't think I've had access to that information. So if somebody is ordered to pretrial services through a private company, we're not tracking them. And the reason I said we had any experience was because one time we contracted with an outside contractor for pretrial services.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And we're just about out of time, but on this probation and parole slide, it looks like since 2018 it's been relatively flat. And I'm just curious, this is something for later, if you can get the number of potential people who could be paroled at any one time. And I'm sure those numbers are pretty available. And then just sort of an idea of how many per year are actually get paroled. And then the last slide was recidivism. Senator Willikowski.
On that point, Mr. Chairman, does the department think that we should take a look at our parole laws to – I know we've heard some testimony. I mean, is it something that we should be looking at as a legislature?
Through the chair, I'm very hesitant. That's outside of my purview. I mean, I supervise probation and parole officers who do the work that is signed by the parole board, and I think that's more of a parole board question or a question for my commissioner.
It's not really a parole board question, Mr. Chairman. It's maybe a question for the commissioner. I mean, is it we want to keep the public safe, but at the same time, you got 80-year-old people in jail with a lot of medical problems who are probably really no threat to society. Is that Should we be keeping them in jail?
Commissioner Winkleman.
Yeah. For the record, Commissioner Winkleman, thank you for the question. Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, what I will say, while it is a policy call by the legislature, that the geriatric parole and the medical parole statutes as they are written right now are very restrictive. So it is a policy call by the legislature on what to do, but I would say that it makes very few people eligible for medical or geriatric parole as they're written.
Follow-up?
Yeah, and I know we're short on time, Mr. Chair, but I think this is an important issue, and I think, you know, you want to keep the public safe, but at the same time, is it if you have these people who are very sick, who we're paying, they don't get Medicaid, we're paying enormous costs, and they're no threat to society. How would you say our statutes are too strict? How are they strict? Enlighten us a little.
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, I have to get back to you on the specifics of which one. I believe it is the geriatric parole. They have to have served. They can't have certain offenses. They have to have served, I believe, over 10 years. They have to be over 60 years of age. The amount of people within our custody we've looked at that are going to fit that those requirements is very, very, very small. As a matter of fact, I want to say we looked recently, and I want to say there is one, and they're not going to be eligible until 2029. But yet we know that there are many elderly inmates with significant medical issues. And so I think trying to figure out what are they sentenced for? And I will say that many of the long terms are going to be the sex offenders, and they're going to be unclassified or Class A felonies, which get automatically discounted under that. But taking a look at that is certainly a policy call by the legislature. I would say that is the biggest restriction, is the geriatric and the medical parole, and that's the part I'd need the parole board to be able to talk to which is which.
But. And we might at some point have the parole board come before the committee. I think there's also some legislation that's coming through at some point, but we wanted to bring that up, that we heard that there was a 93-year-old that was potentially up before the parole board, and the parole board denied that person. A 93-year-old, yeah. I think you might be familiar with that one. So I don't know. I mean, it does cost. We're looking at the healthcare costs rising, and I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's a reason that person be there so that he gets the community because he's done something bad, and the condemnation that goes with that is necessary. But I don't know. I mean, we just need to make sure that we're not overspending on this healthcare side. It's costing a lot of money. That's going to have to wrap up where we're at. We're right at the recidivism, and it looks pretty flat, but are there any questions for the commissioner, since she's here, in the last 30 seconds? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, we will adjourn the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting. The next meeting is scheduled for March 24th at 3:30 p.m., where we have bills previously heard or scheduled. I will let you know if we are going to have a meeting at the beginning of the week. And if there's no other business to come before the committee, Senate State Affairs is adjourned at 5:02.